John Williams here. Pete Zimmerman produces the Wintrust Business Lunch. We start today with Ben Wink, the markets and economy reporter at Insider.com. Welcome back, Ben. Thanks for joining us. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks so much for having me.
Let's talk about the jobs report sponsored here by Breezy.hr. Good numbers, bad numbers. What do you see in the latest numbers?
Yeah, so as far as jobless claims this morning go, on one hand, the number of Americans filing for unemployment benefits, that's been pretty steady, right? Dropped a little bit to 375,000, and that's not a new pandemic low or anything to be really thrilled about. But on the other hand, continuing claims, now that covers the number of Americans on unemployment benefits, that fell to its lowest point since the pandemic began. And that's been staging a pretty steady decline. So, you know, the number of people on unemployment benefits, that's falling pretty steadily. And that could be a sign that people are, in fact, getting back to work. And the states that are kind of ending that benefit early are seeing what they wanted to see, which is really getting people off of unemployment and back into the workforce.
Boy, another number we heard this week was 10 million. 10 million was the number of job openings, right?
Yeah. So that was the number of job openings at the end of June. And that sort of lags some of the other indicators that we get. But it really just adds to the narrative we've been hearing for several months now that people are having a really hard time hiring, filling their openings. And workers aren't coming off the sideline, unemployed workers, I should say, aren't coming off of the sideline as fast as we would have expected. Now, you know, we got that really good jobs report last week on Friday that showed nearly a million payrolls being added. So people actually, you know, going to these job openings and taking jobs. We'll see how openings change in July, but at least at the end of June, yeah, record high, a little over 10 million. And it really just goes to show, you know, it's going to take some time for all of those openings, all the demand for workers to be filled because people have various reasons to not go right back to work just yet.
Yeah, I get the feeling it's not people not being able to find the right job, but them sitting on their hands because they just don't want to do it. And the reasons are myriad, but I would say among them are pay and conditions. If they didn't like being a waitress or working at a call center, they're not going to be a waitress or work at a call center right now, even as their unemployment benefits expire. I wonder when these people are going to come off the sidelines or what it will take to get them off the sidelines.
Right. So the big deadline or when we might see a lot of action happening is around the fall. Because like you said, we've got unemployment benefits either already expiring, the federal boost expiring in, I think, 26 states now. But then you've also got schools coming back and the new school year starting. So child care costs aren't as big of a burden, and that won't hold people back like it probably did over the summer. And then you've also got, you know, COVID-19 is still around, and the Delta variant has only complicated that further. So maybe people who are thinking about going back into those service industry jobs where you're seeing people all the time, maybe all these Delta variant headlines and the jump in cases, maybe that's holding them back. We'll see how that and vaccinations sort of butt heads, but that's just another factor. And so as we enter the fall, I think schools coming back, unemployment benefits lapsing, those are the two really big things that, in my opinion, could drive this return to work that we've been waiting for a while now.
Ben Wink's on a line from Insider.com. You also authored a piece, Three Signs That the Housing Market is Starting to Get Better. Better meaning what, for the buyer or the seller?
So for a while, for the buyer, I should say, just off the bat, it's been a seller's market now and a really good seller's market for a while, right? We've seen prices climb at record pace for several months. Now we start to see some indications that buyers just aren't having it. They're saying, prices are so high and bidding wars are so crazy and homes are being sold in a matter of days after being listed, that they're stepping back. And so we're starting to see the first signs of maybe this housing boom that's happened throughout much of 2020 and now through most of this year is starting to recede. Selling prices, the median selling price, dropped for the first time in 5 months. It was hitting record highs every single month for a while. And then inventory is, builders are shoring up inventory, and that means there are more choices for people who are looking to buy homes, and maybe that will help tamper down on those bidding wars.
I saw number three on your list, too, is competition is fading away. I had a conversation with Amy Kite, AmyWillSellYourHome.com. I was talking to Amy at lunch the other day, and I may get this metric wrong, but it was something like this. For the first time in several months, the average selling price of a home was below ask. Everybody was getting ask or above ask or something like that. But suddenly now it's starting to cool off a little bit. That's good news for the buyers. And I suppose your reporting reflects that as well, right, Ben?
Absolutely. I think it's a combination of things you can sort of take as how that competition is fading away. For sure, it's how many homes are being sold above their listing price. It's also how many sellers are having to cut their listing prices. They're having to say, you know, or they're realizing, wait a second, these crazy numbers that I thought I could get my home for,
yeah,
that's not going to fly like it would have, you know, earlier this year.
Nice to talk to you, Ben. Let's stay in touch. Keep doing what you're doing over at insider.com.
Thanks so much. Appreciate you having me.
This is the Wintrust Business Lunch. Ian Schur is up next, the editor at large at CNET.com. Hi, Ian. Welcome back.
How you doing?
I'm doing well. Instead of a small business, let's talk about big business, Amazon customers. I actually noticed this Wall Street Journal story the other day and talked about it only so briefly. I'm glad I've got you to ask about this. Are sometimes being offered money or merchandise to delete negative reviews. Are you familiar with this?
Yeah, this is actually a rather common occurrence. You know, if you shop on Amazon, you may get a box that has a little business card in it that typically says, like, you know, contact us to, you know, activate your warranty, or maybe even for a free gift to thank you for being a customer. And what they're doing is they're actually collecting your contact information because Amazon doesn't actually allow them to have it normally. And what happens is that if you leave a negative review for their product, then they will turn around and start harassing some people. And that's what the Wall Street Journal story kind of got into. What's interesting here is that the length to which a lot of these sellers, who are honestly always overseas, are willing to go to try and get these reviews changed. Now, it's really important for them to do that because the reviews determine where they land on search results. And all of the research points to the fact that the first three or four slots in that search result are the most important. People have found that when they try to, you know, juice their results, you know, either by adding special keywords or maybe even buying a competitor's product and leaving negative reviews, yeah, people do that too, what will happen is that they'll go up in the charts. So all of this is against Amazon's rules, which is what's fascinating about it. And Amazon is only now starting to seem to deal with it.
Amazon or otherwise, do you have any tips for us on how to evaluate then reviews? If I'm looking at a product or service, how legit do I know that those ratings usually are?
It is so hard. We've written about this on CNET before, especially around Black Friday, because, you know, there's a lot of tools people want to understand how to make sure they get a good deal, but also whether or not they're buying the right product. One thing I personally do is that I read the one-star reviews. And if they are dramatically different from everyone else's reviews, I get suspicious, right? I start to wonder what's going on. A lot of people also have now gotten so angry at this process that they've started writing into their review that they were asked to change the review.
Absolutely.
So you can edit it and change it. That helps a lot. But it's really hard. There are other companies out there who have tried to fix this problem, too. There's one called Fake Spot. It's the two words, Fake Spot, all one word. And what they do is they actually will give a score to the reviews on a product. And they'll tell you, well, this product on average seems to have a C level of reviews. So that means that half or so of them seem to be fake or paid for or somehow manipulated, and the other half seem to be real. And that seems to help, although Amazon, by the way, has tried to kick them out of the App Store by saying that their database is not accurate.
CNET has a story about why your iPhone may never be made in the USA. What are you saying there?
Yeah, so I decided a while back to start looking into, you know, Made in America is becoming more and more popular recently, and buy local and whatnot, and especially during the pandemic and with our supply chain as fragile as it is, going really disrupted. And what I wanted to figure out was, what was it that was keeping us from making stuff here? And, yeah, there is, like, the obvious stuff, like labor costs are cheaper overseas, regulations are different. But what I also learned talking to a lot of experts, including, by the way, Wahl, right, which makes their hair clippers in Illinois, they said that, you know, a lot of this comes down to you and me. We are making decisions every day when we buy stuff, even though polling's American made. We don't end up buying American-made. We end up going down the street to a big box store or buying over on Amazon, whatever we can find. And that has an impact on the whole system.
That is, because you cut out there for just a second, we're always going to buy the product that's the best for the lowest cost, and America can't compete with our laws or our labor issues. Is that what you're telling me?
Yeah, I mean, it comes down to definitely how many people we have working in these jobs as well. You know, a lot of the experts told me that they are finding that, you can't fill enough of a factory with the right people, and we're not even training the right number of engineers. You know, China a decade ago was graduating more than twice as many engineers as we were. And so a lot of this comes down to how we view ourselves these days. A lot of parents, if you talk to them today, once we're done with this program, and you say, hey, you know, would you want your kid working in manufacturing? Most of them with a good head on their shoulders are going to say, absolutely not. The industry's falling apart. It's going overseas. I don't want my kid to lose their job. And that is causing it part of this problem to continue going on.
Ian Scherz on a phone line. So one statistic I heard once, and this sounds apocryphal, but I believe it to be true, is that China has more straight-A students than we have students. They have a greater population base, and it's a different ethic there, and they're cranking out more smart people to do some of this stuff. So are you saying then that, say, the chip shortage as it is, this is not going to get better anytime soon? We will always be beholden to Vietnam or South Korea or China or someplace?
That is not entirely true, and that is part of what I hoped to get across in the story, is that, in fact, there are promising indications among the polling and the sales data. For example, Wahl sales have gone really high recently, partially because, you know, people need to cut their own hair during the pandemic. But also, actually, there are really good indications that people are investing now in the United States, not because they want to move stuff from overseas, but that they realize they need to diversify where they're manufacturing so that if there's a ship that gets stuck in a port somewhere, as we dealt with over the summer, they can still bring stuff to us.
I was talking to a guy the other day who said stuff on that ship still has not gotten to where it's got to be. And
correct.
I'm sure you're well aware of that. Ian Scherz is an editor-at-large at CNET and can be heard on this station all the time. So it's always good to have your expertise. Thank you, Ian.
Thanks for having me.
From CNET.com. On the Wintrust Business Lunch, here's Daniel Wegner, Senior Vice President for Government Relations for the Inland Real Estate Group of Companies. Inlandgroup.com is the website. I want to talk a little bit about 1031-like exchanges. The government at the federal level is sure spending a lot of money, and one of the ways they're going to pay for it is a revision of the tax code, or at least some changes. And Daniel, that's where you step in. Welcome to the show today. How are you?
Oh, terrific. Thanks for having me today. It's an honor to be here.
We appreciate your expertise. You were also, once upon a time, the president of the Chicagoland Realtors Group or something like that, were you not?
Oh, yeah. The Chicago Association of Realtors is a fabulous organization, and they do a lot every day trying to help our community at every level. So it's been it was an honor to be president of the Realtors as well.
So talk to me about a 1031-like kind exchange. What is that?
Sure. So the 1031-like kind exchange is kind of like the 401k of real estate. You're able to take pre-tax dollars and invest all your money from a sale of a rental property, income-producing property, and you can use the pre-tax dollars to renovate or to grow into a bigger property, and you're able to do that until you sell, and then that's when you pay the tax. So you use the pre-tax dollars to grow your wealth, just like you do in a 401k. And it's been part of our tax code for over 100 years, and people love using it. And it's really the economic development engine for our country. And we have to make sure and educate our elected officials of why it's so important.
They're talking about putting a cap on this, so taxes would be generated from this where they are not currently. Walk me through just a basic thing. Give me some ballpark numbers and just sort of a vague scenario of what we're talking about.
Sure. So a 1031 like an exchange is what they're talking about is capping it for $500,000 for an individual or $1 million for a couple. But when you're talking with about real estate, commercial real estate especially, those numbers really, it's kind of like getting rid of the whole concept of a 1031. Because a 1031 is used in so many different areas. You have in Naperville, for example, the mayor, Cherico, will tell you that the old Kmart building was sold to Costco, and a 1031 exchange was the reason why it was able to be sold, because the person that owned that for so many years would never have sold it because they would have had to pay tons right away in capital gains tax, but instead they were able to take that money and then invest it into something else. So that's why it's such an energizer for the economy. You also have the issue of in Bronzeville, in Chicago, you have the Mariano's that was exists because of the 1031 like-kind exchange. We have a huge development came in from New York and was able to buy this development and then put a whole bunch of money into Bronzeville, and that's another wonderful experience. The farmers use a 1031. Their farmers are cash poor and dirt rich, and they're able to use 1031 to manage their portfolio of properties. And then the conservation world uses a 1031 because they buy things like Birds Unlimited. They buy the land from the farmers to be able to preserve it for wildlife. And so the farmer, again, is able to do the 1031 and be able to provide this great open space for a lot of stuff around Chicago. You know, Chicago, our forest preserves, other places were purchased many years ago from farmers, and farmers 1031. And that's the reason why they're able to do that. They don't have the money to be able to put into the tax right now, but eventually they do, as well as anybody that has, you know, a six flat or whatever it is. That's how they've grown their wealth, and it's been super important over the years.
Did I not see, though, that it's not applicable to everyone or every dollar, that there you have to earn over a certain amount either on the sale or your income has to be above $400,000 or something like that? Can you talk a little bit about that?
You know, anybody can do a 1031. The 1031 like-kind exchange, it can't be for your personal home where you live. So if you want to get if it's a second home that you have that you rent, anything that's rental that you rent, it's an investment property. It's not for flippers or developers. It's for a place that you're going to really hold on to that property for a long time. The other thing, which is really interesting, is that talking to the IBEW out here in DuPage County, they highlighted that the 1031, while many jobs are created because of the 1031, again, the synergy of working with people that own property are going to just maintain it, buyers will renovate. And so the renovation of properties is where you get about 568,000 jobs get generated every year with the 1031 because of all the just economic development that goes on. And so when the union, they like the idea of having jobs, but they also love the idea of being strong. The private unions, they manage their own pensions. And so pension funds are a big investor into real estate investment trusts. Real estate investment trusts uses the 1031 all the time to, again, manage their portfolios. And if they had this cap on it, that would definitely impact everybody's pension returns. And clearly, that's the last thing you want to do if you're managing pension funds for retirees. So it has such broad implications up and down the spectrum. Some people try to say, oh, this is just kind of a loophole for the rich. Well, it very wealthy people use a 1031, and then people that just own a little rental building use a 1031. It's just all across the spectrum. But most importantly is the economic engine that gets created because of the 1031. The interesting aspect of it, we say that this concept of capping it that's been put forward by President Biden is that we say the juice isn't worth the squeeze. And what we mean by that is that this, by the own government accountants, they say that this would generate about $2 billion a year for 10 years to pay for this infrastructure, or the social infrastructure plan of President Biden. But the other the macro and microeconomic studies that have been done on the 1031 show that over $5 billion a year just in state and local transfer taxes and recording fees and depreciation recapture, those taxes are generated every year because of the 1031. So you're really going to lose a net of $3 billion a year. So $5 billion is generated. You do this cap, and you're gonna have less money for government at all levels. So it really doesn't make any sense. As we say, the juice isn't worth the squeeze. It doesn't make sense to do it at all. And we're waking people up to that. And again, in our tax code for 100 years, the reason why it's had such a huge impact on every layer of government. And I'll tell you, call the mayor of Naperville. He's blown away at just how many 1031s have been done over the last 5 years in Naperville alone. I think is $450 million just from one company called the Qualified Intermediary that is able to manage these things.
Daniel Wagner's on a phone line from the Inland Real Estate Group. So we got to wrap this up now, Daniel, but what's the status of that? That's a proposal to help pay for the infrastructure. What's the likelihood that this is going to happen?
Well, that's a great question. Right now, the Senate voted to put forward the $3.5 trillion social infrastructure package, and we're looking at now the Senate Finance Committee and House Ways and Means Committee is going to put together the ways to pay for it, and we're making sure to educate the Democrats on these committees, Republicans, to say, you know, the juice isn't worth the squeeze, and people want to go to the IPA.com website. That would be a wonderful thing, to be able to let your elected officials know that this is not a good thing for anybody in at any level of government or in our economy.
So if you're Googling around, it's called the 1031 like-kind exchange, and there is
right.
One very particular view. I don't say particular to mean small, but I suppose there's another side to this, Daniel. People who might say that the money is well worth the squeeze, but you make a compelling case. Daniel Wagner is the Senior Vice President for Government Relations for the Inland Real Estate Group. InlandGroup.com is the website for them. Daniel, thanks for your time today.
It's been an honor. Thank you so much, and have a great rest of the day.
Yeah, you too, sir. Well put. It's 12:46. The business news continues on the Wintrust Business Lunch with Steve Grzanich.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. The Chicagoland Chamber of Commerce is calling on businesses to mandate COVID-19 vaccines for workers. If businesses don't require the shots, the chamber says companies should implement stringent masking and testing practices. Chamber President and CEO Jack Lavin says the vaccines have been essential in the fight against COVID, and businesses are in a unique position to help change the direction of the pandemic. Chicago-based McDonald's will require its corporate employees to be fully vaccinated before returning to the office. The company is delaying the return date for workers so that they can have more time to get shots. Instead of September 7th, corporate employees will be expected back on October 11th. I'm Steve Brzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minutes.
Filet Mignon Day or something like that.
Well, close to it, Johnny. Let's take a look at the calendar. Today, actually, is National Julienne Fries Day. Those are the long, skinny fries.
Yeah.
Which I think would go great with a nice, juicy, medium-rare filet mignon. And what a coincidence. Tomorrow is National Filet Mignon Day.
Holy cow!
Well, you're close, Harry. The filet mignon comes from steers, not cows, and is generally the most expensive cut of meat from the animal. So when we cook our own, we don't want to mess it up. That's why I've called on an expert from Harry's namesake restaurant chain.
My name is Sean Johnson. I'm the corporate kitchen operations manager for Harry Carey's, and I'm the executive chef of Harry Carey's in Lombard.
Let's begin at the meat counter, Sean. What do we look for?
The marbling is going to really guide you. The more marbling, the higher the grade. Ideally, you want something very uniform in shape and round, because it's going to cook the most evenly.
And when you get it home and you're ready to cook, he says, let it sit out on the counter for a bit.
That air is going to dry it out. That way you'll get a good sear.
And that sear, it's important.
Because that's going to lock in all that flavor and give you a really nice presentation and a nice crust that'll provide a good mouthfeel and texture.
And from there, you either put it in the pan with your butter and spices, or
there's really two ways to cook it, a saute pan or your grill. And if you want to finish it on the grill, you would move it to indirect heat so you don't burn it, and finish it there to the desired temperature.
And that temperature is really important.
Once you take it out of whatever way you choose to cook it, it's going to continue cooking for several minutes. it's very important to take it out 5 to 8 degrees prior to what you're looking for.
For medium rare, the final temperature should be 135, so following Sean's advice, pull it off the fire between 125 and 30. Or you can just go out.
It is absolutely one of our biggest sellers.
Sean Johnson, one of the executive chefs at Harry Caray's. A couple of hours ago, the USDA dropped some crop production and supply numbers on the grain markets. And oh boy, the volatility. After the report, corn, beans, and wheat all jumped over 20 cents a bushel. Right now, corn is still up about 18. Beans are only up about a penny. And wheat now is up about 27 cents per bushel. And that's the business of food on 720 WGN.
The Wintrust Business Lunch, Amy Guth joins us. Let's talk a little bit about the Drake Hotel, Amy. Hi.
Hi, that's right. The Drake Hotel has been put up for sale. So the Breschiers family, who bought the hotel about 1930, they're one of two entities that own it, but they have put that up for sale. And it's you know, analysts are saying that it could fetch somewhere in the neighborhood of $250 million. But I think it'll be really interesting to see who that buyer is, especially right now, after we've seen, you know, travel has been just so clobbered over the last 18 months, who the buyer will be and what, if any, changes they might make to this iconic hotel here in the city.
Wonder if they would turn it into something else. I'm not exactly sure what, but I'd hate to see it not still be the Drake Hotel, you know?
I know. You know, one thing I thought was really interesting, that the Breschiers family, when they got into the Drake ownership, it was the Great Depression. And so it's kind of interesting when they entered the hotel game and versus when they're exiting, two major moments of, you know, economic, a lot of uncertainty going on with them. But, you know, so many things have happened at the Drake. We've seen heads of state stay there. And it's such an iconic thing. I don't think anybody wants to see the brand go away, but it will be very interesting to see who bites on that deal and who ends up with it ultimately.
How much money do they make? Did you say, Amy, if they sell it?
Well, so that particular family, they would gross about $150 million. What's not clear is we don't know what kind of debt the property carries, so that might not all be profit. But overall, it stands to fetch around $250 million.
Reddit is valued at what, did I see?
Yeah, so Reddit has raised another $700 million in another fundraising round led by Fidelity. They had already raised $410 million from Fidelity a while back. So that's a big number, and that puts their valuation to over $10 billion. That sounds like an absolute ton, but when we look at some other platforms, Twitter is $52 billion, and Facebook has a $1 trillion valuation. But nonetheless, Reddit has more than 52 million daily active users and over 100,000 communities. So it's not a small site. There's a lot of activity on it. And, you know, for those who maybe aren't Reddit users, it's essentially an entire network of forums. So you look at whatever you're into, gardening, race cars, whatever, and there are forums there of people that feel just as passionately as you do about that. And you can, you know, look in those and comment and participate in conversations. Of course, you and I have talked about Reddit a couple of times over the last year, just because of the Wall Street Bets forum that has, you know, sparked action on Wall Street, right? From GameStop and AMC and things like that. But so Wall Street is now looking beyond just that into, you know, how many active users and what a big, powerful platform it is, and putting that valuation right there at $10 billion.
30 seconds. Give me a headline on TikTok. What's the news there?
Yeah, so there's been a lot of criticism about protecting younger users, and so they're rolling out some changes for users that are 13 to 17. Part of that is the time of day in which they can receive direct messages. So in the evening hours, you won't be able to, you know, teens won't be able to direct message one another, and other people can't direct message them. But there will also be some privacy settings that will be available to younger users in terms of who can see their content, who can share it, and things like that.
Always a pleasure. Thanks for your help, Amy.
Thanks so much, John.